Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. Bill's goofing off, so he's not near his microphone yet. So I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Oh, sure.
Except my mic wasn't on. There we go. Hey, I'm
because
back.
You're playing musical chairs with the microphones again.
I'm on the wrong mic.
Well, you
No, you're good.
I'm okay.
Well, you're on mic 4 instead of mic 3, but we'll keep you there.
Mic check, mic
hey,
check.
Hey, that wrecks okay. It. Isn't it only mic 1 and mic 2? Oh, that was Joe Dirt.
Oh, that was Joe Dirt.
Sorry.
Yeah. Mic 1 and mic 2.
Get credit for my Joe Dirt reference for today.
Yeah.
And Bob Martin.
And Bob Martin, our magical engineer. So today we're talking about the hoax of climate change.
Yes.
Gosh, and you know what?
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned, we can't talk about this enough.
No.
But we have a rare and fabulous opportunity. We have Lord Christopher Monckton on with us here shortly. They are at our friend Debbie Bacigalupi is at a conference with him down in Arizona. So he'll be on the balance of the program, which is awesome. But their Q&A thing for the conference didn't wrap up until like 5 minutes ago. So we had to give him time to scurry to a location to call us. In the meantime, I really do hope that you go to the website. It's wethepeopleradio.us. You have a ton of information there, not only on this show, but on others. And unlike a lot of programs, we don't just put our archives up in a big long list. We create a page for each program. And while I'm at it, you know, if you would like to reach a decent-sized audience, we get a lot of viewership on the webpage. We really,
yeah, I'm surprised
really
at how much traffic that webpage gets.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, our biggest listening days are Wednesday and Thursday. I mean, besides Sunday. We have huge listenership on Wednesday and Thursday. So I don't know if there's a whole lot of people who have weird shifts that's their weekend, or people are bored in the middle of the week, or they just kind of want to get angry in the middle of the week, so they listen. I don't know. I don't know why, but God love you out there. And viva to Wednesday and Thursday.
And plus, aren't the archives commercial free?
After Sunday night-ish, you know, afternoon-ish, Robert Exter actually puts up a commercial-free archive for us. So the show's then only hour and 35, hour and 40 minutes, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Sometimes if we have two guests, that'll be broken, an hour by hour, so you can listen to the one you want. And, if you know anybody who wants to sponsor the program, put an ad on the website, that kind of thing, get a hold of us. You can go to wethepeopleradio.us, and our emails and phone numbers are right there. Super simple. So we won't load you down with other detail. So, okay, I wanted to play while we were kind of stalling here on the Lord Monckton interview. We found something on his webpage that was fantastic. It's called the 50-to-1 Project. Literally like a ratio, 50 to 1. The website for that is 50to1.net. So the number 5, number 0, or yeah, number 0, to1.net. And it's fantastic. The video is also on our webpage, so that makes it easy.
Do we want to say what the 50 to 1 stands for?
There's a little blurb here. Lord Monckton kind of commissioned this project with Christopher Field. He's the guy you'll hear from. He's from Melbourne, Australia. And it says, what is the true cost of climate change? Is it stopping? Is it stopping it early? Is that really the cheapest plan in the long run? 50 to 1 explores the costs of stopping climate change versus adapting to it, and if it's required.
Yeah, if it's if it's going to happen. They're not saying it's going to happen
exactly.
Or is happening. But,
and so just like here's your spoiler alert, it uncovers the simple truth. It's 50 times more expensive to try and stop climate change than it is to simply adapt to it. So we're going to play this because I really think it gives you good things to talk to people about, and I hope you'll go and watch their – they have fun graphics too. Obviously, we can't do that for you on the radio, but good enough. So here's the 50-to-1 project with Christopher Field, and we'll come back hopefully with Lord Monckton.
What if I could show you that it's 50 times more expensive to try and stop climate change than it is to adapt to climate change as and if it happens? It's 50-to-1, and I'll prove it using data that's accepted by the IPCC, provide all my references along the way, and we'll even have time to hear from a few scientists, researchers, economists, and investigative journalists that the mainstream media haven't told you about. You ready? Carbon taxes and emissions trading schemes are supposed to reduce CO2 emissions to reduce climate change. But despite lots of talk all over the world, atmospheric CO2 continues to rise, and the IPCC predicts 3 degrees Celsius of warming by the end of this century. But never fear, Australia is here. Despite a lack of action elsewhere in the world, the land down under stepped up in 2012 and introduced the most ambitious and expensive carbon tax anywhere in the world. It's been estimated that it cut their CO2 emissions by 5%, which, given that Australia's emissions are 1.2% of the global total, the scheme would have reduced global CO2 emissions by 0.06%. What that means is that instead of atmospheric CO2 rising to 410 parts per million by the end of the decade, it would rise to a mere 409.988 parts per million. Which isn't a particularly useful number, but if we calculate the resulting cuts of climatic CO2 forcing, which, as you know in this case, is 5.35 times the logarithm of 410 divided by 409.988, or 0.00016 watts per square metre, obviously, and then multiply that by the 10-year climate sensitivity parameter, 0.33 of a watt per square metre, we finally know how many degrees the Australian carbon tax would have saved after 10 years. 0.00005 degrees Celsius. 1/20,000th of a degree. Now, the smallest global temperature change we can reliably detect is 1/20th of a degree. So even if the Australian carbon tax had worked as advertised, the temperature change after 10 years would have been 1,000 times smaller than what we can measure. Now, this is a problem that affects every carbon emissions reduction scheme ever invented. Mark Morano, former journalist and editor of ClimateDepot.com, said it best.
Because not a single proposal they've ever done would have any detectable impact on global warming using their science.
So after 10 years, the Australian tax would have changed the global temperature by 1/20,000th of 1 degree. But that's not all. That 20,000th of a degree would have come at a cost of $160 billion. Which means if we theoretically expanded the Australian scheme internationally and made it big enough to save a full degree of warming, it would cost $3.2 quadrillion for 1 degree. Ouch!
So many millions of dollars are wasted, and people have worked hard to pay their taxes and to see the government just pouring them down the sink.
I think what we need to do is look at the money. This is all about money.
So how much is $3.2 quadrillion? Well, a column of 3.2 quadrillion Australian $1 coins would go from Earth around the furthest planet in the solar system. No, Pluto, we've been through this. You're not a planet anymore. And back again, via the Sun, with 600 million in loose change, and would weigh as much as 72 million fully laden 747s. With $3.2 quadrillion, you could spend $1 million every day for the next 8.5 million years, and still be richer than Bill Gates. It's a lot of money, and all of that needs to be spent to save 1 degree Celsius.
You can take so-called action and do all manner of harm. I mean, that, of course, is not part of the calculation, because you have to talk about cost benefits in all directions, not just one direction.
Let's bring this back to Earth, shall we? Predicted global warming for the next decade is 0.17 of a degree. Just to stop that 0.17, we would need to spend $540 trillion. That's $77,000 for every man, woman, or child on Earth. It's 80% of the entire planet's GDP. That means effectively that we would have to cut average economic activity and therefore the average standard of living to 1/5 of what it is worldwide, just to ensure that it doesn't get a little bit warmer this decade. Surely there are better things to do with our money.
We could have improved our lives. We could have improved the lives of others in countless ways with that same money and effort. And here we are wasting it.
The greatest thing you can have for rising seas, for extreme weather, for hurricanes and storms and tsunamis, is wealth. Wealth to invest in infrastructure, wealth to invest in dams, wealth to invest in all sorts of storm mitigation efforts. And that is what they're denying the developing world.
So stopping climate change using carbon taxes and trading schemes will cost about 80% of global GDP. But that's only half the equation. Remember I said that I would show that it's 50 times more expensive to try and stop climate change than it is to adapt to it as and if it happens? Well, what is the cost of adapting to climate change? Many people say that carbon taxes and trading schemes are like taking out an insurance policy. It's worth spending the money just in case, right? Better safe than sorry? We need to know what climate change might cost us if we don't stop it. Thankfully, we have the answer in the 2006 Stern Report on Climate Economics. It concludes that if the planet warms by 3 degrees this century, it would cause damage of 0 to 3% of GDP. So climate change will cost us roughly 1.5% of global GDP if we simply adapt to it as required, or 80% of GDP if we try and stop it. 50 to 1. That sounds like a bad deal to me.
This idea that we should do it because it's insurance, that comes up all the time. It's just crazy. If you had a $50,000 car and someone said the insurance for it for a year was going to cost you $50,000, you would be barking mad to say yes, please.
Would you buy an insurance policy on your home that was cost more than the house is worth and that would pay out nothing if your house burned down? That's the snake oil they're selling us.
The Australian carbon tax in its original form set the highest price per tonne of CO2 anywhere in the world by a long shot. But even then, the price wasn't high enough to make a measurable difference to the temperature. Now, after only a year, they've slashed the carbon price to reduce the cost of the scheme, but cutting the price makes the scheme even less effective. So the cost-to-benefit ratio remains immeasurable.
Well, it means it's a tremendous waste not only of effort, but of money and resources. It is not addressing the right problems.
We're smart, we're ingenious, we are creative, and we will solve the problems that come our way, and so will our children and grandchildren.
The numbers don't lie. This so-called insurance of the Australian carbon scheme was 50 times more expensive than the cost of adapting to climate change as and if it happens. 50 to 1. And the revised Australian scheme, as well as the European emissions trading scheme, the now defunct Chicago scheme, and any other schemes our politicians might dream up in the future, will all suffer the same basic flaw. If they are expensive enough to be effective, they aren't going to be affordable. And if they're affordable, they aren't going to be effective. So, what should we do?
I just think we need to stop being so worried and just take a pragmatic approach to increasing efficiency, improving our energy production, and going down different pathways for energy production. And we'll get to where people say we should be without having to tax people and without having to change our lifestyles in a negative way.
Pretending we can stop climate change is a waste of time, money, and opportunity, and may actually be doing more harm than good. You can see the maths behind the 50 to 1 project, as well as extended interviews with all the people you've seen in this video, at 50to1.net. My name's Topher, and this is the 50 to 1 project.
Stop being afraid. I think that's the most single most important thing. Stop being afraid and start thinking.
To see the full 50 to 1 project interviews and full referencing of all source data or to join their mailing list, I can't keep up with it.
I was going to try to read it too. Yeah. There are all sorts of little things at the end that tell you all about it. But
yeah, go to the web, look up
the 50 to 1 project.
Stop being afraid. I think that's the single most important thing.
Good advice.
On every front.
There's the address. It's 50to1.net, which I think you had referenced already.
50to1.net. And you can find them on our website, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be back, hopefully, with Christopher Monckton, and we'll chat some more about the climate hoax.
And if you want to call in, the number is 530-605-4567. This is KCNR 1460. You're listening to We the People.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? What do they want?
Don't be.
Don't
be absurd, you know.
And we're back.
Okay, so our evil plan worked.
Lord Monckton was jammed up in a conference, so we played you the 50-to-1 video, hoping that our timing would be perfect. And it is.
Oh, you know, I just want to add real quick that the 50-to-1 project, all that stuff is based on the premise of if climate change is real,
right,
and if it's happening at the rate that they say it is, which we still haven't really proven in my mind.
Yeah. So just in case you've been living under a rock, internationally known speaker Lord Christopher Walter Monckton was a policy advisor to Margaret Thatcher. Sure, easy for me to say. In 2016, he was a national leader in rallying the British vote on behalf of Brexit. He's an expert on climate change fraud, and he'll focus talks locally here in Northern California, by the way, on December 5th and 6th. 5th, he'll be in he'll be in Yuba City. Here we go. Church of Glad Tidings in Yuba City. I have a flyer for that on the website. He'll be in Wairika, and that's getting sold out. That's $15 a head. You better plan ahead. It's at the Miners Inn, and that includes dinner. And so that's December 6th. So if you would like to check out either of those, I've got flyers for both on the website, wethepeopleradio.us. And he's in the Bay Area prior to that. We'll give you that information shortly. So I know you've been at a conference and you're probably all talked out, but Lord Monckton, what have you got for us? We'll go any direction you want.
Well, the question is that Lord Monckton is never talked out. my lovely wife calls me a motor mouth, and
nice.
She says that it's very relaxing when I'm at home because she never has to say anything.
That's fantastic. We were really kind of counting on that, but thought we'd give you, a little out if you wanted it, but not really.
No, don't you worry. I'm all fired up and ready to go. What would you like me to talk about?
Well, you know, since we discovered the 50-to-1 project on your website as a way to sort of educate people a bit on what you've been doing, maybe you could give folks a little bit on that and how that's been working and go anywhere you want from there.
Well, let's begin with the 50-to-1 project. This was really a project which I cooked up in Australia with Topher Field, who is a very talented young presenter. And so I called him up, having seen one or two of his excellent videos on YouTube, and I said, look, I need some help in explaining just how cripplingly expensive Australia's proposals to try to make non-existent global warming go away actually are. So he came along and he said, well, it's all very complicated, the economics. I said, look, I've boiled it down to a single page, and here it is. And your mission is in 5 minutes with graphics and you doing the voiceover and you doing the text. And I'll simply make sure that you've got it right, but otherwise I won't prescribe what you do. You need to tell the story that it is 50 times more expensive to act today to make global warming go away, even if the amount of global warming is as much as they predicted, and so far it's running at about half what they originally predicted in 1990, even if it was going to warm as fast as they said, then it would still be cheaper, 50 times cheaper, to let the global warming happen and pay the far later and far lesser cost of adaptation to it than to attempt all the crazy policies that Australia and now so many other countries have adopted to try to make this non-existent problem go away.
And you're not saying, let's just fire up the coal plants and pollute the heck out of things. Let's, we can still employ rational plans to keep the air clean. But in the meantime, this whole carbon tax thing is a total farce.
Exactly. The carbon tax was a stupid idea, and Australia eventually ditched it, as you know. But under Tony Abbott, I'm not quite sure what they've done since then with Turnbull, who, of course, being an absolute banker, is making a fortune from pretending climate change is a problem. And so he can't be persuaded to take the rational view on any of this. But let's be very clear that those of us who question the amount of global warming that we are likely to expect as a result of our enrichment of the atmosphere with carbon dioxide are not saying that therefore there is no such thing as any kind of pollution. We are saying, and saying very clearly and very loudly, that not only is carbon dioxide not pollution, it is plant food. It is essential, absolutely essential to all life on Earth. About a third of our bodies are made of carbon. So anybody who says they want a low-carbon economy is saying they want to do away with all mammalian life on Earth. And that's not a terribly good idea if you are a mammal, as we are. So we are saying that carbon dioxide is actually a good thing and that it has been declining. You're probably too young to remember, but over the last 140 million years, carbon dioxide has been relentlessly declining in its concentration. In fact, if you were to go back to, I remember this well, 750 million years, to the Neo-Proterozoic era, at that time there was 7,000 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. Now it's only 400 parts per million.
And at that time,
And at that time, the planet was
totally green at that time, right?
Well, the more carbon dioxide, the more green it gets, of course, because there's always a certain problem with some parts of the planet not getting as much water as they would like. Australia being a good example of that, of course. All the desert regions at 30 degrees north and south where the Hadley cells deliver the hot air from the equator down to the surface. So the Sahara Desert is the biggest of those, of course. And what we've noticed as the carbon dioxide has increased in the atmosphere is that these regions that were previously arid are now greening again because there's a bit more moisture in the atmosphere because of the warmer weather, but also there's a lot more CO2. And what that means is that the stomata, the little mouths on the underside of the leaves of plants, through which they breathe in the carbon dioxide that we breathe out, and then they turn it into oxygen and, of course, the carbon, which is what their leaves and trunks are mostly made of. That process happens much more easily. They don't need so many stomata, so many mouths underneath the leaves. And it's through the stomata that the plants lose water, which they get chiefly from the ground. And so if you have more carbon dioxide, a plant will grow with far less water. And this is very important for agriculture worldwide. One of the reasons why there's been an enormous increase in the net plant productivity, as it's called, which is the total biomass of green stuff, growing stuff, all over the planet. It's actually gone up by somewhere between 15 and 30% over the last 30 or 40 years as a result of what is called CO2 enrichment, CO2 being actually a good thing for the atmosphere and therefore for the plants. This has been an enormous. Therefore, these plants need less water so that they can survive in the more arid regions. And it's particularly in the arid regions that you get often these famines because there's just no water and no rainfall and nothing grows. But with CO2 increasing, then those regions can survive much more easily with not so much water. So that's an important point too. But we're not saying there is no such thing as pollution. We also are saying there's no such thing in modern conditions as CO2 pollution, because even if it went up to 7,000 parts per million, which it was 750 million years ago, then it would still not fry the planet. CO2 does have some warming effect. There is such a thing as a greenhouse effect. Get over it. It's well understood down to the quantum level, where one of the vibrational modes of the CO2 molecule, specifically the bending mode, will interact with the photon of near-infrared radiation, and it will set up an oscillation at the quantum level, and this oscillation is, by definition, heat. So we know that these little carbon dioxide molecules, the more of them you put up there, the more of them will interact with radiation that comes off the Earth, typically at around 15 microns, which is fairly close to the peak absorption band of CO2. And therefore what happens is that it's like turning on lots of little radiators, and so heat is given directly out into the atmosphere as these molecules are excited and as they vibrate, and that oscillation is by definition heat. So anyone who tries to say, well, there's no such thing as a greenhouse head is a pointy head. Of course there's a greenhouse effect. But the question has always been, and the real debate in the scientific literature has been, how much global warming will a relatively small amount of CO2 extra in the atmosphere cause? And there's no way of saying that there is a consensus on this, because there actually isn't. And even if there were, it wouldn't matter, because just because you are told that a lot of people agree on a certain thing, it doesn't mean that there are a lot of them, still less that they agree, and still less that even if they do agree, they're right.
That's right.
The fact of a consensus tells you nothing about the truth or falsity of the proposition to which the consensus is said to adhere. And it was Aristotle, 2,350 years ago, who first listed the argument from consensus, later to be known by the medieval schoolmen as the argumentum ad populum, or the fallacy of headcount, as one of the forms of, one of the dozen most common forms of bogus argument or fallacy that is common in human discourse. And these logical fallacies led him later on to write two further books, The Prior and Posterior Analytics, in which the science and art of logic was first more or less completely explained. It was an astonishing work of intellect. And the whole of science and mathematics today is based on Aristotelian logic. And so when they come along and start saying, well, we are scientists and we say there's a consensus and therefore you've got to believe us, they are departing from the scientific method, they're departing from logic, and they're getting into mere politics. So that even if there were a consensus, which as it happens there isn't, it would tell us nothing about whether we should worry. And is there a consensus anyway? No, there isn't, because we surveyed, I and my colleagues, and this is a peer-reviewed result, 11,944 papers on climate and related topics published in the peer-reviewed literature of climate science and related subjects over the 21 years 1991 to 2011, and we found that only 41 papers, which is 0.3% of the entire sample, would even go so far as to say explicitly that most of the global warming since 1950 was caused by us. That's how small the supposed consensus actually is. And it's a milk and water consensus proposition anyway. The fact that most of the warming was caused by us, if it is a fact, and neither I nor anyone else can tell you whether it is a fact, we simply don't know, it still wouldn't indicate that global warming is dangerous. And none of the surveys of the supposed consensus among scientists on this issue has ever asked the question, do you think that global warming at the rate that is predicted is or ever could be dangerous? Because they'd get an even smaller agreement than 0.3% if they did.
So I got a question. You said earlier that in the last, 10 or 40 years or whatever, the CO2 levels have gone up 30%. What do you attribute that to?
Plant biomass has gone up by 30%, 15 to 30% in the last few decades.
Okay.
Yeah, and the plant biomass, that's the total volume of all trees and plants that are growing on Earth. And we can measure this from satellite. And it's a very interesting measurement because you can plot it graphically. And we were shown an example of this by Professor Will Happer yesterday morning here at the conference. And he is one of the most talented physicists on the planet. And he'd looked at this. And he said the satellites are showing very clearly there's this enormous increase in plant biomass. And this is notwithstanding deforestation, forest fires, and all the things that the media are endlessly banging on about. The one thing they never tell you is that in net terms, the plant biomass, or net primary productivity of plants, as it's officially called by scientists, has actually massively increased thanks to CO2 fertilization in the last 50 or 60 years.
And so the question is that a bad thing or a good thing? And that's what a lot of...
Well, the first thing is the increase in net primary productivity of plants is unquestionably, from every point of view, a very good thing.
Sure.
The
mm-hmm.
question is, do you have to pay for that by a much warmer climate? And would a warmer climate be a bad thing? Well, of course, the answer is it wouldn't on the whole be a bad thing. As long as the warming were relatively modest, say less than 3 to 4 degrees Celsius over the next 400 or 500 years, then we really don't have very much to worry about, because warmer weather is infinitely better for life on Earth than colder. 90% of all species on Earth thrive in the warm and wet tropics, compared with only 1% at the cold and dry poles. So the idea that somehow extending the ice extent is a good idea and that global cooling is what we should be striving for, that would kill many times more people than global warming would. And in fact, global warming up to about 2 degrees Celsius, even the UN's climate panel, which is an awful lot of bedwetters, they have accepted that that would be net beneficial. And the rate of global warming has been so small over the last 20 years. It's been at a rate far, far less than they thought. In fact, for 18 and three-quarter of those 20 years, there's been no global warming at all. It was a complete pause in global warming, notwithstanding increases in CO2 concentration at a rate greater than they had originally predicted. We're way above the high end or business as usual case for CO2 increases, and yet for the last 20 years, when there should have been an acceleration in warming, there has in fact been a decline.
Well, that's just fun for everyone. Lord Monckton, we have Dane Wigington on the line who has a question for you. Hopefully you guys
just can... Just a moment, would you? I've got to clear a noise that's coming on my phone. Hang on just a moment.
No problem. It's coming on our phone, too. It's kind of a... Yeah, that weird...
Like a feedback loop thing.
Might have to... what do you think? Maybe can we take a break, a quick break, and
right,
let him do that?
Right,
it did. It did? It work?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I'm fixed now.
That's much better. I think we need to take a break real quick.
No, we're good.
We're good? Okay.
I just thought we might need to solve for time, but, oh, that solved it. We were hearing it on our end, too.
Yes, I'm sorry about that.
No, it's all right.
Somebody else's phone, and they'd set a couple of alarms, which went off in the middle of me talking.
Oh, that's kind of funny, because that's what it sounded like. It sounded like somebody's phone buzzing. Okay. Do we have both guys on?
We do.
Okay. Go ahead, Dane. Or not.
Hello?
There you go.
You're on.
Hello, yes.
I can barely hear you guys. Mr. Monckton.
Yes.
I have a question for you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
You know, I'm not sure which question to ask because this string of unsubstantiated and incomplete...
Start with one and we'll work through it.
...opposition to science study, the statements I've heard you made is incredibly
Start
long, but I would ask this.
And we'll work through
you don't believe CO2 is a problem for the oceans?
Right, so your first question is about the oceans, yes?
So you feel the more CO2 is the better. I heard you state that the biomass of the planet has increased, even though we've lost 55% of Earth's tree cover since the dawn of civilization.
Yes,
you
the
don't
extraordinary
think
thing
is
that the net
and I would encourage listeners certainly to invest in
okay,
everything
Dane, Dane, let him answer.
Take it at face value, but I'm asking you a question. Do you think CO2 is a problem for the oceans, for example?
What problem are you talking of?
Well, we have ocean acidification right now from the buildup of CO2 that's wreaking havoc in oceans around the globe. We've lost
Can you tell
most
me
of
what
the Great
the
Barrier Reef. We've lost most of the kelp forest ecosystems around the globe. We have shellfish that can't form their shells. We have oyster
Hang
farms.
Hang on a moment. One thing at a time. Can we...
do you think it's a problem? That's my question.
What
do you
is
feel...
the mean pH of the globe?
I can barely hear you.
Let him
what
answer.
Is the
Let
mean
him answer, Dane.
pH, okay. That's Papa Hotel, pH of the global ocean.
Yes.
What is the answer to that question?
What is the pH?
What's the proper pH?
About 8.3.
What is the pH of the ocean? I'm asking you.
I just told you.
What is it? What's the figure?
I just told you, 8.3.
Oh, 8.3. Thank you very much. Right. And what was it 50 years ago?
How about if we ask what it is now? Because now it's
8.2.
No, you've
just told me it's 8.3.
And that's a radical change. It's not that we're talking about changes of a magnitude of 10 for every full point. So we have ocean acidification going on around the globe, which any listener
I'm sorry. I'm asking you to give me what was the pH 50 years ago and what is the pH today?
8.3 50 years ago, about 8.2 today.
Sorry, what was it before?
8.3.
Do you not know these figures?
From 8.3 to 8.2. Right. And is that acid or alkaline?
You know, it's astounding that you can make, if you don't even know the
Dane.
Answer to that.
Hey, Dane, if you want to ask a question, great, or we'll be, just be done with this.
But the point
question.
Is, the oceans survive without alkalinity. As they become
right, so
more acidic,
exactly.
as they move
so
toward
they are, so
neutral,
so when
organisms can't survive when they're adapted to an alkaline environment.
Wait a minute. So when we're talking of ocean acidification, we are lying. Because there hasn't been any acidification, it's still pronouncedly alkaline. And furthermore,
you know, that's,
when
that's,
I ask you
anybody who knows anything
about
science on this line,
pH of the ocean,
for you to act
no,
like,
okay,
because it's not
Dane,
low
we're getting done here.
What the pH of the ocean was, we don't know what it was 50 years ago, and we don't know what it is today, because there is no systematic global program of measurement of ocean pH. There have been a few transects only, and there are one or two fairly short-run, localized data sets, which, of course, can be very easily distorted by local factors. So we have no observed data that any scientist would regard as adequate for determining whether or not the ocean has acidified, as you call it, we can be sure that it hasn't, in fact, acidified, because, as you have had to admit, the pH is well above 7, which is neutral, and if it's well above 7, it means it's alkaline. So let's start by getting the facts straight and being honest and not talking of acidification.
Well, nothing screams I'm interested in your answer like hanging up, so that's awesome. So,
well, the moment you confront these people with the data and the facts, they find it very difficult to deal with. There's no doubt about this. And, you know, he was trying to say, for instance, let's try and argue it for him since he's gone off the line and there may have been a technical problem. We don't know. Let's be nice and assume that was the case. He was talking, for instance, of calcifying organisms having difficulty in making their shells. Now, calcifying organisms are creatures that make calcium carbonate, which, of course, includes carbon dioxide in its matrix. You get, in fact, an extra oxygen molecule. You get also a calcium molecule added to the CO2, and you get CaCO3, which is chalk, and it's also seashells. And what he's trying to say is that if you acidify the ocean, then what will happen is that these calcifying organisms cannot make their shells, or it becomes more difficult for them to do so. Now, the reason why some people think this is that the early experiments on acidification of the oceans actually added acid to ocean water. But if you do that, you drive the chemical reaction in precisely the wrong direction. So you don't get a correct answer from doing that. What we can say is that, because I think he was trying to suggest also that the ocean had never been acid. In fact, it had. For a brief period of perhaps 1,000 years, we can't tell exactly, 54 million years ago. And at that time, the ocean was acid, and yet the corals, for instance, the calcite corals evolved and first achieved algal symbiosis 550 million years ago. Along then came the more delicate aragonite corals about 175 million years ago, this time in the Jurassic rather than the Cambrian for the calcites. And so all of these corals had existed long before this period when the whole ocean on Earth was somewhat acid, and they survived. So the idea that a little change in the alkalinity of the ocean, a little de-alkalinization, would somehow cause an enormous difficulty, there is no basis for saying that that's the case. The corals have survived all this time. They're not going to be affected by some tiny change in the pH of the oceans, even if there has been one. But would we expect there to have been a large one? Here are some figures again, because I do things by the scientific method, which means I go and look up the figures and I get the data. And the answer is that we have something like 70 times as much carbon dioxide already dissolved in the oceans as we have in the atmosphere. So even if the entire CO2 that's now in the atmosphere ended up in the oceans, it would make virtually no difference to the calcifying organisms whatsoever. So ocean so-called acidification is a chimera. It's the backstop. When they realized that global warming was not happening at the rate they had originally predicted, what they did was to move on to this backstop position that ocean so-called acidification was happening. And, of course, your caller walked into my two traps. He first of all admitted that the ocean was, in fact, alkaline, and then he had to admit, perhaps by terminating the call, that therefore calling it acidification was a straight lie. And so let's be very clear. I'm not going to take any prisoners on this program. You've got to know your stuff, and you've got to be honest, or I'll have you for breakfast.
See, that's why we're real quiet over here. we're just over here with our little pom-poms. Go, go, go. That's why we love having guys like you on. We did have Leighton Stewart on. I think we've had him on twice, and then we replay him all the time because he's just so much fun. But
well, of course, he is a very great man and a formidable expert on exactly what I've just been fumblingly talking about.
Well, he gave us, those of us who are not scientists but do love a good example that is fairly emasculating. He had told us that since the parts per million of carbon in the air is 400, he said, so when we used to use mouth-to-mouth resuscitation as a first aid maneuver. We still do periodically. I guess it's not as much as before. I don't know. Anyway, we did it for years. And he said, when you breathe into another person, it's like 40,000 parts per million. So if CO2 was a pollutant, we would have killed everybody. And it's like...
Exactly. And of course, what do they do? If you have breathing difficulties and you go into hospital, they make you breathe air with 10,000 parts per million CO2 in it.
Yeah.
And this is because it actually facilitates breathing if there's plenty of CO2 in the air. So certainly, and if you look at the CO2 limits in American submarines, for instance, which are well below the levels of toxicity. I think they allow something like 5,000 parts per million.
Oh, that's right. I do remember he said something about that.
So we know that as far as all life on Earth that breathes, the fact that CO2 might one day even go back to 7,000 parts per million, I don't think it will, because, of course, the CO2 has calcified thanks to these shell-making organisms, and they die and go to the bottom. And that's where the various forms of limestone come from. First, you get limestone. Then, as the partial pressure of CO2 above the ocean drops, you get gypsum. And now there's so little partial pressure of CO2 over the ocean that there's just not enough to precipitate any form of stone as a result of this calcification. So these shells are now just dropping to the bottom and piling up there. But it's very interesting, all this, that there's been so much distortion by the so-called Greens, who are profiteering mightily out of this global warming scam.
Sure.
Well, and one of the spookiest things they said is, oh, global ocean acidification, the corals are dying back. And I asked my brother, who swims once a year off the Great Barrier Reef, and he's a great diver, and he goes down to enormous depth, and he faffs around down there. I said, is there a sign of the oceans, the coral reef, the barrier reef dying back? He said, no. He said, I've never seen it looking so healthy. He said, there is at the southern end an encroachment of crown of thorns starfish, but that's nothing to do with us. That's a natural predator, which eventually forms a balance with the coral. And he said, you do get in years of very strong El Nino, such as 1998 or earlier this year, you get coral bleaching. And then, of course, you get all the bedwetters coming out and saying, oh, the corals are dead. No, they're not. This is a natural reaction to a temporary warming of the ocean. They're used to much warmer temperatures. But if there's a sudden change in temperature, they will temporarily bleach. And this has happened twice before in the past 300 years, but of course the greenies wouldn't know any of this because they've never studied it. And each time in response to a very strong El Nino. And we've got very good records
that
reconstruct all this. So again, the idea that the coral reefs are all disappearing has absolutely no foundation, in fact, except in one or two places like the Carteret Islands, which for a brief period until I got into the debate were a poster child for how the coral reefs were disappearing beneath the rising ocean. And what was in fact happening, as I very soon found out by talking to my nearest geologist, was that the atoll on which the Carteret Islands stand is itself perched. The coral is perched on the rim of an extinct volcano, which by natural tectonic processes is crumbling beneath them. So the whole thing is sinking beneath the waves. It's not that the sea level is rising, it's that the land is sinking. And this you get a lot. I mean, I had a very distressed caller the other day saying, oh, sea level is rising here in Norfolk where I am. And he said, you know, whole villages are being wiped out and it's all terrible. It's all because of global warming and we must close down capitalism and communism must be universal everywhere. And I said, hang on a moment. I said, yes, of course, they're all using this global warming rubbish as an excuse for communism. But the fact is that what's happening in Norfolk is that as the tectonic rebound or recovery following the last ice age continues because there are vast glaciers in northwestern England and Scotland, which have now gone, they went 9,000 years ago, the whole tectonic plate on which the United Kingdom stands is changing so that on the northwest it's rising up out of the sea, and on the east it's being pushed under the sea. And again, it has nothing to do with sea level rise and everything to do with natural tectonic response to the global warming that occurred between 11,000 and 9,000 years ago. Same applies to the
east coast
of the United States. Florida's going to be underwater because of global warming. No, it's going to be underwater, if anything, because of tectonic movement.
Nice. All right. Well, hold that thought. We've got to take a really quick break here before the top of the hour, and we'll come back.
All very bad.
We'll be right back. You are listening to Lord Christopher Monckton. He is on We the People Radio. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. We've got about 2.5 minutes till we get to the break for the news. So Dane has called back, and he'd like to state his question and then take his answer off the air, which I think will be a better way to do it. We won't have these I can't hear you problems. So fire away, Dane.
I can hear you barely now. Thank you, Aaron. I'll leave one question and I'll take it off the air. Lord Monckton, countless sites, including Wikipedia, The Guardian, and other sites, make clear that you are not, in fact, a lord at all. Is that the case, and can you answer us off air?
Well, it's awesome that it was at least on topic. That's fantastic. So that's on the air. Yeah, you want to run up that hill?
I'm simply going to get my passport out of my pocket, and I will read the words in the box the holder of this passport is. And it says, the holder is the Right Honourable Christopher Walter, Viscount Monckton of Brenchley. And that means, yes, I am a lord. I am a hereditary peer. I have no seat or vote in the House of Lords because that was taken away in my father's generation from very nearly all hereditary peers. I am, however, a peer of the realm. I am a member of the House of Lords, albeit without the right to sit or vote. So get over it. If the Home Office says I am the Viscount Monckton of Brenchley, then I am the Viscount Monckton of Brenchley. And yet again, your caller is hopelessly prejudiced and misinformed.
So can we now get back on topic?
Yeah,
I'm so glad we got that straight.
I was going to say, geez, Louise, this is why programs have call screeners. I mean, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, could we talk about something less relevant? That's fantastic.
They do that, of course, because they realize I am a huge danger to this communist project, and I'm calling it communist because if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, it probably is a communist. And so the fact is that these people have lost the scientific debate, they've lost the economic debate, and they're trying to win the political debate by vilifying those who have proved effective in arguing for rationality and science and proper economics. And this technique, which the left now use universally, and we on the centre-right are far too nice to do it back to them, but they got this originally from their ideological soulmate, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi director of propaganda, who in 1933 wrote a front-page story in the Daily Express saying what a friend Germany was to Britain. Well, of course, that proved to be nonsense. And Goebbels first developed the technique of identifying those, both nationally and internationally, who were proving effective in arguing against, in his case, fascism, which is just another kind of totalitarianism, barely indistinguishable from communism, actually.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to get cut off here by the top of the hour.
Absolutely. Okay. So how nice to have that little Goebbels interruption there, and we'll be back with We the People Radio.